Good evening and welcome to Barclay and Barton on Love Sport. We're trawling through the archives to produce a post-war history on the great Manchester United, all the way from Busby and Murphy right through to the present day. It's me, Matt Beadle, joined by renowned but retired, I must say, sports journalist and documenter of many a past United manager with a series of autobiographies on his CV. Patrick Barclay, hello sir.
Hello.
And United historian and author Wayne Barton also joins us. Hello, Wayne.
Hello.
Okay, gents, on with the show. Episode 2, Too Good to Go Down.
This is Love Sport.
So, Too Good to Go Down. This references United's departure from the top flight in 1974, just 6 years after being crowned European champions on that glorious evening at Wembley, which we did discuss in the previous show, by the way. And a quick note that you can download and subscribe to the podcast via lovesportradio.com. But Wayne, it all started in the summer of 1969. So Matt Busby moves upstairs and Wolf McGuinness steps in at, when you think of it now, the incredibly tender age of just 31.
It was a bold move from Manchester United and a very ambitious one. Something that I don't think had been done before in football, appointing from within, the idea that Wilf would carry on the same ideals as taught to him from Sir Matt and Jimmy Murphy. Matt had retired in January, or he'd announced his retirement in January, and the famous headline that came from that, I think it was in the Express, it said, "Sir Matt, I've lost my grip," which reflected his opinions about the modern game, the way that it was going, the sort of growing celebrity status of football. I think he was becoming disassociated with it. I never knew him personally, so I can't vouch for his personal drive and ambition, but you always got the impression that Wembley had been the pinnacle. There was no need for him to carry on. He'd achieve what he needed to achieve. He was growing tired of the game.
And you couldn't do the Shankly, Paisley, one steps down, the other one steps up. You couldn't do that because Matt and Jimmy Murphy were growing old together.
Absolutely. And Jimmy himself, his role had become a little bit confuddled over time. He still loved being on the training pitch and coaching the players, but he also liked being with the youth players. He was also doing a lot of scouting of opponents and players as well. The roles had sort of changed over time. Yes. And I guess that Matt thought it was the right time to make a change. Wilf, it was the right idea for me.
I agree. A lot of people are revisiting and saying what a ridiculously bad decision by Matt to appoint Wilf. It was the way they went about it, but it did make sense.
Yeah.
Wilf was not a mug. Wilf had been, his career had been ended early by injury, so much so that he'd gone into coaching in his mid-20s. As an example of how well he was doing, he was on Alf Ramsey's bench in 66, only less than 3 years earlier than the period we're talking about, as a member of England's World Cup winning team. In fact, he was probably the third, you know, number three after Harold Shepherdson and Alf Ramsey there. So, you know, he wasn't a mug, you know. And Matt thought he could do the coaching while Matt did the admin. But unfortunately, it didn't work. And Ken Ramsden pointed out that the idea was that among Matt's duties would be the media, which obviously he was a master of. Wilf would pick the team, would be the coach. So Wilf would get a call from a journalist on the Friday asking who was fit for the next day match. And he'd say, "You have to speak to the boss." And the journalist would ring Matt, who would say, "I don't know. You have to speak to Wilf about team affairs." So it was bizarre. And it did affect perceptions, certainly among the media. But, you know, the relationship between the media and the players was much closer in those days. It affected perceptions of Wilf's real strength. If you add to that the fact that even before his injury, although he was a very, very good player, he wasn't in the class of Law, Best and Charlton. So he did have a credibility problem. And while I agree with you, Wayne, that it was a good idea, it was sort of almost like what later became the Liverpool boot room. In practice, it wasn't as collegiate as that, was it?
Not to be too over-dramatic about it, but it was disastrous the way that he actually worked out. Willie Morgan came out, and this probably best sums it up. He said Bobby Charlton should have got the job. And what that meant effectively when translated into what actually happened was McGuinness wasn't respected in the same way that Charlton was by the team and by the squad. The best will in the world was there for Busby to do that and to take a step back. I would never be the one to say that he interfered, but the problem came was the muddling of that relationship of knowing who picked the team and who didn't. So sometimes if a player was unhappy that they were dropped, they would go to Busby.
Straight to Busby.
Busby, not wanting to interfere, but wanting to make everything plain sailing again, would often try and smooth that over. In his own way, he would try and smooth that over. And it worked for the short term, but not to the benefit of McGuinness, because it constantly eroded his credibility. And McGuinness at that time, he didn't want, obviously wanted to do things his own way, but in the way that had been taught to him as the United way. But he had the shadows of Busby and Murphy looming large over him. Busby was still there, very active. Wilf was so deferential to Jimmy that he didn't want to ask his opinion for anything. So Jimmy, on the other hand, was feeling marginalised and left out, and he was doing more scouting. Almost no coaching whatsoever, so he was doing the scouting for the players. McGuinness was trying to do it all on his own, and he did quite well. I mean, he got to a couple of semi-finals in there.
Yeah, two or three, I think.
And he was so unlucky, because if one of those had gone for him, it would have changed this entire idea of the esteem in which he was held as a coach.
Yep.
But it was a matter of what was going to win out first, the players battling against him or him winning something.
Yeah, one trophy would have enabled him to make his own decision, drop Law and Charlton as he once did on the same day, which caused, you can imagine, the trouble. And there's no bigger enemy than an ageing footballer.
Yeah.
But he didn't win one of those. Yeah, he didn't get to one of those finals and win it. Although, to get to the semi-finals with an ageing team wasn't bad. But he just didn't quite make the breakthrough.
Well, if we fast forward 2 years then since his appointment, Sir Matt obviously came in, and then we have a scenario, I suppose, akin to Ferguson Moyes in a sense, of the chosen one, in a way, with Franco Farrell coming in. And I think what's really interesting about this particular appointment was that it started quite well, right? The appointment was pretty good at the time. He came flying out of the blocks, but then gradually we saw money being spent. We saw results not turning out the way we wanted. We saw relations fractured with George Best, for example, like you mentioned.
Franco Farrell, that was his. There's one other point that needs to be made. His, right from the start, he never trusted Busby an inch, and he had good reason, because his interview was held in German Louis Edwards's Rolls Royce on a lay-by on a road in Leicestershire. Franco Farrell had been very successful young manager of Leicester at that time, taking them into the top division with a certain amount of style. So there's no question he was one of the managers to watch in the country. So he was drove his car to this country road, and they went into Louis Edwards's Rolls Royce, and Frank asked Matt, "What's the salary?" And he was given a figure. And Louis Edwards says, no, Matt, it's that figure plus 10%, 20%. In other words, Matt was trying to penny pinch on the salary. And O'Farrell said that from that minute, I never trusted him. So that didn't help, because Matt was still, I think you'd agree, Wayne, the main man at the club.
Absolutely, yeah.
And when a player had to be signed, Matt would make the signing. Ian Ure came to, I think it was during Wilf's time.
Yeah.
And he came and he said, Matt did the deal. Ian Ure had a tremendous reputation in Scotland with Dundee. And he'd gone to Arsenal and not done so well. Well, the reason for this, which nobody at United twigged, was that his knees were shot. Ian told me that he was having pills that he later found out were the same ones that they gave to horses to get them racing. You wouldn't be able to give them now. I mean, if a doctor did that, he'd be struck off. But that, Matt said, Matt had seen a punch-up between Ian Ure and Dennis Law on the pitch and thought, this is the man I want. He's got the attitude to replace Bill Foulkes. So it was just signs that Matt was, although he was still making the signings, that he was kind of losing, to quote himself, losing his grip a little bit. In other words, he wasn't as state of the art as he had been through his career, as the bulk of his career.
The players had responded very well very early on to Malcolm Musgrove.
Yes, the coach of number two to O'Farrell, yeah.
Their approach on football was, it revitalised that ageing squad for United. And so it worked very well for 6 months. United were playing brilliant. George Best was in some of his most outstanding form. I don't think people appreciate that the famous hat-trick against West Ham, where he embarrassed Bobby Moore, that came in the O'Farrell era.
Yes.
So United were flying. O'Farrell was open and talkative to the press. There was always the idea that he was skating on thin ice, really, because everything was going well while the team was fit and doing well. But once it got to the bumpy pitches in the winter and a couple of players picked up their injuries, Best began to lose interest because United, they hit an alarming run of form. They started losing all the games. And George Best wasn't interested in working in a team that, you know, he wanted to be the one at the top of the shiny diamond doing great things and didn't want to pull the hard work. Allegedly, that's so O'Farrell would have it. And O'Farrell actually dropped Best for a game in January, which was pretty... It sparkled at the Dell a few weeks prior to that. He was in the form of his career, some would say. He's absolutely blistering opponents. And then to go from that to dropped in just a matter of weeks shows how dangerously thin that relationship really was. O'Farrell, I feel, wanted to make some bold statements with that. Best was a massive bold statement. But as soon as the forms started to drop off, O'Farrell became more distant with the press. He didn't like the knives going in for him. You know, he was being heralded as Britain's best coach, and then all of a sudden it was like, oh, what's going wrong at Old Trafford? So he retreated a little bit. And Paddy Creran said it best when he said, O'Farrell came as a stranger and left as a stranger. That the players never had a really true relationship with him. And when things were going bad, and when players started to be dropped again, Bobby Charlton was a famous example. He was dropped at the start of the following season. Busby intervened again, which O'Farrell did not take very kindly to. And I think even O'Farrell's wife had a few words to say to Busby about that. It became this massive political battle going on behind the scenes, which O'Farrell was, he was destined to lose.
Yeah.
And it was only, that was a year into his reign at Old Trafford, you know.
Right.
And O'Farrell had taken some kind of umbrage or offence to that earlier thing with Busby, and he got off the wrong foot with him. And really, any relationship works on both sides, doesn't it? You've got to work at it to make it work, and you're not going to dislodge Busby at Manchester United. So part of the onus was on O'Farrell to kind of build that bridge and try and make that relationship workable, instead of saying, even though he was entitled to do that as a coach and probably wanted to do that for the authority, considering what had happened to McGuinness, it was, for the same reasons in a way, destined to fail because you weren't going to win that battle. But the major thing was Best had grown so disillusioned with life at United that he quit and he wasn't happy. I mean, there was a couple of occasions where he said he was going to walk out on United, and then I think O'Farrell put him on the transfer list a few weeks before O'Farrell eventually got sacked. There was an headline saying Best is going to get sacked, and that was because O'Farrell was going to, he'd had enough and he was putting him on the transfer list. And it's interesting to know that from all of the accounts of the players that played with George in those days, they would never have put that behaviour down to his drinking.
No.
They just said he was wayward and didn't like the responsibility of playing in a weakened and worsening side. And
he wasn't an obvious drunk. No, definitely not. He wasn't. In fact, in his early days, George, I remember Jimmy Ryan, who later became a coach at United and whose son is now. Jimmy said that when he and George Best were great pals, he said one of the things that we had in common is that we didn't drink. George would buy a bottle of the weakest beer he could find and make it, half of it, last the whole night. So, no, his drinking accelerated towards the end of his career. And he was definitely a big factor in the destruction of the O'Farrell regime. Another one that often gets overlooked is that O'Farrell made a great signing. In fact, Matt Busby made the signing, but the player was Ian Storey Moore. Wonderful. Now, he was a Manchester United player. You know, people talk about Manchester, somebody who was big enough and good enough to play for Manchester United and enough of a crowd thriller to play for Manchester United. Well, Ian Storey Moore was a winger who scored 1 in 3, 1 in 2 as well. You know, he was a real top player. But unfortunately, sort of, he was signed by Matt, actually, with Frank also in the car. But Ian Storey Moore had been on with the club a few months when he jumped for a high ball in training, landed on a hard pitch at the Cliff, the old training ground, and landed on so awkwardly on his ankle that he never played again. And he, you know, to this day, says that the medical, some of the ideas he got, you know, for curing the problem, which was curable, were just laughable. In fact, you know, at one stage he was sent to a faith healer. And he thinks Matt had a hand in that. Yeah.
It's Eileen Drury, way ahead of his
time. Yeah, exactly. Well, maybe Eileen could have sorted it out. On top of that, there was the politics that led, you know, people who know Manchester United to say basically Frank was shafted by the players, by everybody, and that was the end of him.
Yes, it certainly was. Time for a new era, you might say. And I think the powers that be had a certain someone in mind, didn't they? That's coming next on Barkley and Barton here on Love Sport.
This is Love Sport.
It is Barkley and Barton, a post-war history of Manchester United here on Love Sport. Right now, episode 2, Too Good to Go Down. We are focusing on life after Sir Matt Busby. First Wilf McGuinness, then Franco Farrell, and then December 1972. A new era, an eventful era, was ushered into Old Trafford under a charismatic, a ruthless, I suppose you could say, a lovable Tommy Doherty. Paddy, you noticed a slight trend here in United choosing their managers.
Well, it is true that when Manchester United sack a manager, they, and it's still to an extent true, they go for his opposite in the next choice. They're not the only club to do this. But, I mean, for example, when Wilf, inexperienced, lacking in gravitas, Wilf was sacked, they went for Jock Steen. That was the first choice to replace Wilf. Didn't get him. But, you know, the complete opposite. Then along comes Franco Farrell, dignified, suit and tie. When he goes, they go back to a more extrovert, showman, wisecracking Tommy Doherty. And that was actually a really good decision.
It was. And just to be fair, I think Doherty was probably the opposite of everything United had probably stood for at that point.
That's right.
I think Busby probably, because Doherty was such a likeable character and a warm guy and a funny guy, that in those early days, I think it was great for everyone, obviously, because it was a new relationship, everyone got on. I think it was more later on when Doherty would come out with the more controversial statements, and then the idea behind the scenes, the political idea was, is this behaviour befitting of a man who's Manchester United manager? But that problem certainly wasn't there in the early days. Doherty's first problem really was to navigate the exit of Lowe, Charlton and Best. Not so much Best, he'd quit, he'd walked out after being sacked, for want of a better phrase, you know, he wasn't at the club anymore. So the first thing was to deal with Dennis Lowe, who had many, many injury problems, like Paddy said in the earlier episode, with his knee, is really beginning to catch up with him.
Yeah, and Dennis said that he lost count of the number of games that he played under injection. Almost half the games he played for Manchester United were played under injection.
And not that it was, I mean, not that it was Dennis's fault, but from Doherty's perception walking in, he was watching this player not train in the week, get injections on the Friday or the Saturday, play on the Saturday, and then not train again.
Well, there's young players fit and training and not getting in the team. Mm. You can see. And do you not agree, Wayne, that Doc's ruthlessness was absolutely what Manchester United needed? You know, they needed someone who almost enjoyed bombing out these guys, which Wilf wouldn't have done because they were his mates.
Yeah.
Doherty wasn't afraid of not being liked. And he backed it up, of course, by the bounce and the improvement that he brought to United's football. Straight away, the crowds went up. For a battle against relegation, the crowds went up because Doherty's bounce and jaunty attitude was being expressed by the players on the field, and he changed the team. I mean, dramatic surgery was done without an anaesthetic in a very short time.
Yeah, it was necessary. And the other thing with the players, I mean, Lowe and Charlton. So Lowe was a more obvious case because he was nearing the end. Doherty always thanks Bobby Charlton for going to him and saying that he wanted to retire. Mm. I think it was crucial for those two decisions to be made in the first few months of Doherty's reign.
Yes.
Because if he'd have waited another year, those players would have got the better of him.
Yeah.
So I think that's why he was allowed to do it in such a short space of time and why it was allowed to be done at that time. And from then on, because he'd made two major decisions like that and Best was gone, I think he had a little bit more leeway with what he was doing with bringing George back.
He also disempowered and neutralised Matt.
Yeah.
Because what Doherty did, which was probably one of the cleverest things he did. He played the chairman. He played Louis Edwards. He went, almost clambered over Matt's lap to sit next to Louis Edwards and charmed Louis Edwards in a way that no one else had been able to do. So, because when Matt and Louis Edwards, who had been lifelong friends, Tommy Doherty broke that up, and that gave him the power to make the changes that the others couldn't do.
So he made the changes, like you said. The old guard were out, the new guard came in. And if we fast forward 6 years from that emphatic European Cup triumph that we spoke about in the previous episode, Manchester United, the unthinkable, and let's dispel a very quick myth, of course. Dennis Law did not send Manchester United down.
No, that's quickly. We'll get that elephant out of the room. Usher it out. Yeah.
But yes, 1974, Manchester United are relegated to what was then, of course, the second division.
Yeah, it was incredible, and it was no less a shock as if it would have happened today, especially the speed in which it happened. You've got to remember, though, at that time the divisions were a lot stronger, so the second division was not such a chasm away from the first division. They were quite close in terms of quality. I mean, United were in the second division, but there were two more future European Cup winners in that division with them. So it gives you an idea of the strength and the coaching quality that was all over the country at the time. United, they went down because they had a major confidence drop after George Best came back, and he wasn't the same George. They were hoping that George would inspire them, and he eventually left in January 74. United were left with a bunch of kids who hadn't done it. You got the likes of Sammy McElroy, Lou McCorry, who'd come in for a lot of money, Brian Greenough, Martin Buchan, potentially great players, but low on confidence because all they'd gone through is this low patch of form, and they couldn't inspire themselves to play. Well, they couldn't get out of the shell to play good football with all this pressure that was on them because they weren't low, because they weren't Best or Charlton. There was a lot of pressure there on those players to step up and be European Cup winners and European Player of the Year, and they weren't that. So they had to find their own identity all in this time of fighting against relegation. For some of those attacking players like McElroy, who had suffered a serious car crash, and he had a lung injury. So coming back, he had to sort of learn to express himself and play for 90 minutes, which was done gradually by Tommy, which was really a masterful piece of coaching and managing. Yes.
And also, I mean, in a way, the drop down to the second division, and Wayne's already explained that it wasn't Armageddon like it is now, or it doesn't feel like Armageddon, despite parachute payments. You know, it is a chasm, that. And it wasn't then if you had the players. And the Dock had bought a lot of good players in an attempt to stave off relegation. But they, of course, were different class in the second division. I'm talking about Lou McCorry, £200,000 from Celtic, you know, a top international, and what's more, a winner, you know, a competitor, a guy who'd won titles at Celtic, was used to winning titles, and really got quite nasty if he wasn't winning games, you know. Jim Holton, a marvellous, a cult hero, the late Jim Holton, unfortunately now. But he wasn't a bad player. He was massive, massive guy, but a good player as well. In fact, he signed four Scots, plus, just as important, two Irishmen. Gerry Daly, who was a superb midfield player, and in the second division was just majestic. And McMartin, a bit more of a scuffler, tackler, but decent player. So they had really a fantastic team for that division, didn't they? And the crowds were huge. The crowds went up when they were relegated.
They had the best attendance in the country, even in second division.
More than the champions, who were Leeds, I think, or Liverpool.
A crucial thing, I think, that happened for Doherty, and I've never been able to get to the bottom of this because the nature of the conversation is disputed, that sometime in the spring of the relegation season, it was alleged that Busby went to Doherty and said, "We've got to go down playing. If we're going to go down playing like Manchester United." That coincided with the signing of Jim McAleog, who took a weight off expectation, of goal-scoring expectation off the younger players, and he contributed a few goals himself. And United, those players came out of the shell, and they did go down fighting. The weight of expectation on the game against Manchester City in the last couple of games, it got a little bit too much for them. I think they suffered badly when they'd had a really good run of form, and then they played at Birmingham, and there was a free goal conceded against them. And Birmingham were fellow relegation strugglers, and they just thought it was going against them at that point. but like Paddy said, they went into second division and the team was instantly good enough to come back. They were much better than they were showing in the first division, but incidentally. So it was a matter of getting that confidence in them to play better. And because they were playing against weaker sides, the divisions were a lot closer in quality than they are today, but they were still, it was still weaker nonetheless, and United were still a lot better than most of the teams. Yeah. They were blistering most of those teams.
So they came out of that second division without too much. There's never any doubt. I can remember it at the time as a neutral, you know, thinking it's just inexorable, this.
Yeah.
And they were equipped to do okay on the return to the top division, but maybe not to do as well as they did. And the reason they did, all they lacked was a couple of wingers. And guess who returned to the scene to help out? Jimmy Murphy. He'd been rejuvenated, I think, Wayne, by the Doc coming back and putting a bit of, lead in United's pencil again, you know? And the Doc was astute enough to use him as a scout. And he found, I don't know if he found Gordon Hill, but he found, for the right wing, a lad at Tranmere, a university student called Steve Coppell. And now, if you've talked about the all-time top wingers at Manchester United, Steve would be very much in that conversation. Is that fair?
Absolutely. He played over 100 games consecutively, didn't he? Under Doherty and Sexton, I think that it spanned over that period. But Coppell was a hard-working, industrious, relentlessly consistent right-sided foil to Gordon.
Interesting that you should say right-sided foil, because I remember interviewing him not long after he left United and calling him a winger, and he rejected that description.
Right-sided midfielder. And that's very much the case, especially with the Sexton, because that's it sums up exactly what they wanted with that. But yeah, it was a great find by Jimmy Murphy. Jimmy was doing a lot of scouting, like Paddy says. Tommy brought him back into the fold. They shared similar ideas on how football should be played, and they were playing the way that Jimmy Murphy loved football being played. This is going straight back to the time when Jimmy Murphy was observing Jimmy Hogan coaching the guys in France. So that was the style of football that Tommy Docherty had been raised on at Celtic, because he was taught by Jimmy Hogan. The actual style and brand of identity of football that's being played at the time, Jimmy was falling back in love with United after falling out of love with United for a long time. There's a great story of Gordon Hill and it was a few months after, so something must have happened in the meantime. I think what had happened, even though his relationship with the club was getting better with Tommy, the Matt's penny-pinching in terms of the way that the funds should be distributed was not helping Jimmy, who was close to retirement. And they stopped his taxi money, so he had to start getting trains to and from games. One of these games they went to see was Gordon Hill playing up at, I think it must have been Tranmere, because it was quite local. Playing for Millwall, and he went up to see him. And after, he only watched like half of the game, and he was so certain. So he went back in time to be able to have a drink with his son, Jimmy Jr., at his local.
The Throstles?
The Throstles, yep. And they were at the Throstles having a drink. So Jimmy Jr. asked Jimmy, "What have you gone to see?" He said, "Oh, a lad called Gordon Hill. He's a cert to make it. He's got a beautiful left foot. He'll fit perfectly into this Manchester United side. But you know what, Jimmy? You know what, son? I just don't think I'm going to bother my arse about it because they don't care about me at the club anymore."
Really?
And Jimmy Jr. said to him, "You will. And you know why you will? Because you're too honest."
Yeah.
That conversation, Jimmy walked from the pub to a phone box and called Tommy at Old Trafford and said, "You've got to sign him before anyone else does." Because all the London top clubs were after him, and they struck that deal that night.
The query is up. Hill trying to count it and does! Gordon Hill! And all around the ground now, all you can see is red and white of Manchester United. And there's the happiest Londoner that ever went to Manchester.
This is Love Sport.
This is Barclay and Barton here on Love Sport, a post-war history of Manchester United. Before the ads, we were discussing Messrs. Gordon Hill and Steve Coppell. Now, for a modern Manchester United fan like me, I always look at those two and think Ryan Giggs and Andrej Kanchelskis of that 94 side.
Good shout.
But you've got some interesting stories on those two as well.
Yeah, those two were... And younger people, probably, they know that they were two... Coppell and Hill were one of the great pairs of wingers. But there were very, very contrasting. I mean, you talked about Giggs and Kanchelskis. You know, Kanchelskis very, very, I was going to say one-dimensional, but he said that dimension was pretty dynamic. But these two were probably the most contrasting pair of wide players you could ever see. I mean, Wayne talked very eloquently about how pragmatic a player Steve Coppell was. Gordon Hill was the one who made it a Manchester United partnership. He was this stardust, if you like. Less practical. Occasionally you would see Doc or his assistant Tommy Cavanagh screaming at him, track back, you know, do something, you know, just one pragmatic thing in 90 minutes. But he more than made up for it. He was a thrilling player. As Wayne said earlier, you know, a lot of clubs were after him, and no wonder, because he was a winger with pace, trickery, ability with a dead ball, also scored loads of goals from open play. For a winger, it was phenomenal. We talked earlier about Ian Storey-Moore. Well, Gordon Hill, including penalties, his goal-scoring record, I would back, would be not far off.
It was, I did the record on this because I obviously worked with Gordon on his autobiography.
Yeah.
And the his record, his goal-scoring record was similar to Cristiano Ronaldo's in terms of,
wow,
you know, his output. And if he had matched Ryan Giggs' appearance,
yes,
so I think his goal scoring would have been somewhere, yeah, about 300. He was not just a great goal scorer.
Yeah.
He was a goal scorer of great goals as well.
And it, made them, yeah.
Yeah.
And when you think of what was his great performance, it would be in the cup semi-final against Derby County.
Absolutely, yeah. That's a seminal one that everyone remembers. He scored a great goal from open play, which I'm always at pains to remind, because I work with Brian Greenough as well, the late Brian Greenough,
yeah,
always at pains to remind. The first goal against Derby County was the perfect summary of United under Tommy Docherty.
Yeah.
You've got Brian Greenough breaking from the back,
yes,
marauding, and this is a centre-half that Docherty, he loved to big up his players. He described Greenough as his Beckenbauer. But there was a great story about Brian, and he was the ultimate Docherty devotee. He absolutely loved Tommy, and there was a great story. Brian played in almost every position for United.
Yes.
In fact, he did play in every position. I'm pretty sure he did. I think they said the only one that he didn't play was left wing. He even played, yeah, in goal for a time.
I mean, sometimes he'd play in centre-half and you thought he was playing midfield.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
It was incredible.
There was one game against, I think it was Birmingham. He suffered concussion and he came off the pitch and he didn't know,
yeah,
like he didn't know who he was. So Tommy Docherty raced down to the sideline and said, tell him he's George Best and send him back.
Yeah, that was... but yeah, it's typical. Now, we're talking lovingly about these players now. That was what the Docherty era was all about. Okay, Tom was the star, really.
Yeah.
And I really do... I'm glad we're dwelling on him because I think he was a very important figure. And we were talking about Manchester United's history. He made Manchester United feel like Manchester United again. And he really put the Busby succession jinx to bed.
The great thing what they said about him at the time, and I always dismiss this as romanticising, but all of the great loyal, I call them loyalists of Docherty's, McElroy, Greenough, Hill,
yes,
Pearson, they will always say that they resembled the great Barcelona side of the 2000s. And the reason why they would say that is because it was 100-mile-an-hour football,
mm,
but controlled with possession and done clinically. There's a distinct difference with the way that Barcelona did it and United did it, but it's based on the same principle, which goes back to Docherty's teachings under Jimmy Hogan, is that it was economic use of the football to get the ball in the net as quickly as possible, whereas Barcelona's interpretation was to stifle the opposition, doing it the same way by a different method.
Yeah.
It's the same principle. So people would disregard, wasn't quite that, but they were playing brilliant football. And if you ask any United supporter of that era, many of them will rank that Docherty side as playing better football than any under Ferguson. And I think that's a testament to the job that Docherty did. And I don't think it should be disregarded. And like you were saying, the perfect summary of that is in Gordon's first goal in semi-final in 76, where Brian brings the ball out of defence. Hill has switched wings with Coppell. He's come over to the right-hand side, cuts inside, and it's a thunderous left-foot shot into the net, and Hillsborough went crazy.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I think that's really key as well, what you've both said there, because I think that gets forgotten as well with the Doc and the,
yeah,
fact that his legacy was perhaps stained with what happened afterwards, and we'll get on to that.
Good.
But how good could this team have become, Wayne? I know you've alluded to it. The fact that the English league at the time, the top flight, was so good. You had the likes of Liverpool, Villa and Forest. United,
yes,
obviously, the Dock led them to successive FA Cup finals, winning,
yeah,
in 1977, of course. But Could they or should they have gone one better, do you think?
Oh, they would have done. I think so. Certainly, you know, you'd expect the players to feel that, but certainly Sammy McIlroy felt that. I think they needed maybe a couple more players, and they would definitely have been consistent title challengers. You know, once you've won the title, you start getting mentioned among the great teams. Part of the reason that the Docks' legacy, I think, has been, if anything, understated in the past, although I hope we're trying to put that right now, was that they never won the title. But they would have done, but for the circumstances that we'll no doubt talk about.
Yeah, I think they were good enough. The first team was probably good enough to do that, but they needed strengthening as a squad. They needed a couple of players. They probably needed another goal scorer, another robust defender, perhaps. Villa and Forest make the best argument for Doherty's United doing well because they went on to win the league and
the European Cup.
And the European Cup. They both did that. So that is the best argument for Doherty because that's in the absence of what they would have gone on to do. I do think perhaps that they did need strengthening to do that. It wasn't just a case of that, you know, that 11 players or that squad of players going on to do it. I think they did need a little bit of strengthening in the appropriate areas. Doherty was trying to do that as well. There was some political wrangling going on behind the scenes. It wasn't all rosy in the garden. He'd got rid of Willie Morgan, who was well-connected at the club and well-loved at the club. And then he discarded Paddy Crerand as well. And these two, they were closely connected with Matt Busby. They would see him regularly. From that point, probably around 76, it wasn't, you know, Doherty was becoming well-liked by, you know, loved, universally loved by the supporters and the players. Even Stepney, who didn't really like Doherty because Doherty wanted Shilton, Peter Shilton. He kept trying to sign him, and that would have been at Stepney's end of his career. But even Stepney, in the end, grew to love him. I think because under Doherty, they won the FA Cup. And this tells you everything about the FA Cup, which we were speaking about earlier, and the esteem in which it was held. Stepney desperately wanted that trophy. He'd won the league and he'd won the European Cup, but nothing mattered to him as much as winning that FA Cup. So he was glad for Doherty to have done that. And so their difficult relationship was effectively repaired by that. But there was a lot of things going on. Busby was growing disillusioned by the growing figures in the game. He would eventually, we'll talk about it on another episode, but with the Brian Robson transfer, he really saw his backside about that one. But the Shilton one, he did not want to commit to breaking the wage structure to bring in a top-class goalkeeper. The argument that United had, well, Doherty had, was that it would make all the difference to winning a league title. There's an actual tangible argument for that in the first year they came back into the first division. United were chasing the title, and what did for them was a 1-0 home defeat to Stoke City, in which Peter Shilton was a man mounting and saved everything that United threw at him. So he would have made a tangible difference playing on one side as opposed to the other. I'm not saying it's as simple as saying Shilton comes in, United win a league and a European Cup.
But I think it's fair to say that the Docks, I mean, obviously going for Shilton, you might say, well, that's painting by numbers. You know, who's the number one goalkeeper? We'll sign him. But Manchester United had got a lot more clout by now. I mean, in the season before they won the FA Cup, they finished third in the league. Their average crowd was 25% higher than that of the champions, Liverpool. They were becoming very, very successful club. And the Dock was buying well. I mean, one that hardly ever gets mentioned is Stuart Houston. Who was a tremendous player for Manchester United and cost £55,000. A player we've not talked about yet and would be remiss to talk about this era without talking about Martin Buchan.
Absolutely.
You talked about Brian Greenough, this fantastically entertaining central defender or midfield player. When Greenough was marauding, and I mean, you wouldn't want to stop him, Martin Buchan had to mind the shop at the back. And he was a footballer as well. He was a pure footballer, but a magnificent defender as well. You know, we need to mention Martin Buchan as a very, very important piece of cement in the Manchester United edifice of that
probably
time.
Gordon Hill, talent-wise aside, Martin was clearly the best player in that team.
He was, in
terms of stature.
He was
the captain. He also led by example. He was the epitome of a Manchester United captain. If you want someone who was going to uphold the standards and the integrity, he was the shop steward, you know, as it was often said about Gary Neville. He was I think it's often said about him that he was a Rolls Royce of a centre half.
Yes,
he really was magnificent player. You're often seeing in terms of referring to central defence partnerships. You'd say that one is the brute and one is the footballer.
Yes,
but they were two footballers.
Yes,
and Martin was absolutely brilliant. Very funny as well. Very funny guy. Very deadpan.
The velocity story was ascribed to him. A journalist said, can I have a quick word, Martin? And he said, velocity. I mean...
Gordon Strachan later took that one, didn't he?
Yes, it's been ascribed to others, but I'm convinced that it was Martin's. Yeah. He's certainly intelligent enough. Yeah, those were great times. And you can tell by the way we were talking about that era, you know. And then something did go wrong. Tommy Docherty fell in love.
Ooh, what a cliffhanger. A first for Barkley and Barton here on Love Sport. Stick with us to find out just what happened.
This is Love Sport.
It's Barkley and Barton and a post-war history of Manchester United here on Love Sport. Now, Paddy, you ended that last section by saying, and then something did go wrong. Tommy Docherty fell in love. Tell me, what could possibly be wrong with that?
Well, it was he fell in love with someone other than his wife of 27 years, Agnes Docherty. More complicated than that was the fact that he fell in love with Mary Brown, who was the wife of the club physiotherapist, Laurie Brown, at Manchester United. Now, those of us who were around in that era still, you know, pinch ourselves when we think of that, because the dog, his assistant, Tommy Kavanagh, and Laurie Brown seemed an inseparable little trio. You would go into a hotel where Manchester United were playing, and there would be Tommy Kavanagh, and Laurie sitting in a table watching the comings and goings, and in front of them would be a pot of tea or a bottle of champagne, depending on what time of the day it was. And they would just seem like the best of chums. And, you know, you could always stop and have a natter with them. So it was obviously a shock to everybody at the club to learn about the relationship between Mary and the doc. The club obviously then had a decision to make when it became public. They took, with Matt's input, without question, and the input perhaps of some directors' wives as well, and it was decided that Laurie shouldn't go as the, you know, in inverted commas, innocent party, or the helpless party. And so it was decided that Doc would go. He'd been assured that his job wasn't at risk, but it was. And I think Matt, devout Catholic that he was, devout family man that he was, definitely had an influence in convincing the chairman, Louis Edwards, of what should happen.
It's an interesting story. It's one of those moral quandaries, isn't it? Like, what do you do in that situation? I think from the owner's perspective, from Louis Edwards and Martin Edwards, I think they were prepared to back Tommy. They really, like you said, Louis and Tommy were close friends, and Martin had a tremendous affection for Tommy. It was with great reluctance that they were convinced. So I think if he had an argument with anyone on the board, it was going to be anyone but Edwards. Do you know what I mean? That's the way that it came across. For me, having worked with Tommy, having worked with so many of his disciples, the players that really vouch for him, you can't help but get carried away, and I know we've said it a lot on this series, romanticising, but you can't help it when they're extolling the virtues of how great they were as players and how great their teammates were. I can't get away from the fact that it would have been nigh on impossible for Docherty to have carried on as manager. And that's saying that as someone who absolutely adores Tommy.
So it may have been a practical decision rather than a purely moral one.
I think
you're right. The more I think about it, yeah. I remember thinking at the time that Manchester United were doing what they wanted to do as well as what they felt was right. In other words, they weren't deliberately ripping up an era that promised the title.
There was no question that it was sabotage on that scale, because even if it was convenient to get rid of him, I still think it was reluctant. And I say this as someone, again, I'll vouch for Tommy. In my opinion, looking back at the history of United, I know the other managers have won European trophies. For me, Doherty ranks at number three behind Busby and Ferguson, whichever order you want to put them in, because of what the rebuilding work that he had to do and the footballing job that he did. In terms of the team that he built, I still have him at number three. But I can't get away from the idea that some of the players had started to fall out with him. There was a famous, well, infamous story of when they went to Australia and he'd withheld some of the bonuses from some of the players, and there was a big political fight. Martin Buchan wasn't going to stand for that, so they had a big argument. The good thing, Doherty loved Buchan because he would talk back to him, so he never minded that, but there were other players that he wasn't so enamoured with, and if you cross Doherty, he might get a little bit bitter and twisted towards you. That, well, that was the accusation from some of them.
I agree with that, and I think also, looking back on it, there was an element, you know, they talk about Jose Mourinho and third season syndrome and all that. I think the history of Tommy Doherty did suggest that there was an element of that, even at Chelsea. You know, it sort of gone in bitterness, where he built a very fine side. It had ended in bitterness. And I think there's also one thing before we leave this subject that needs to be said, that this was not, although you can imagine the terrorist chants that followed that, the ribald sort of attitude. But, of course, it wasn't a passing fancy between Tommy and Mary. It was a marriage that lasted for, you know, 40 years plus. You know, it was a great love. To that extent, for those two, if not Manchester United, the episode had an extremely happy ending.
OK, and just to finish on this particular show then, Paddy, the legacy that Tommy Doherty left at United, other than putting a FA Cup lid on his head, of course.
That's the image, isn't it?
Yeah. In terms of going down, coming back up, how he set about rebuilding that squad. You said yourself, Wayne, he's in there in your top three United managers.
I would say, I mean, Atkinson, you can, I mean, like,
we'll get on
like,
to him.
Yeah,
no
like you can argue the toss between Ferguson and Busby. It's the same for me for Doherty and Atkinson. Yes. They're interchangeable.
Yes, yes.
So,
and I mean, I think, you know, you asked, What's the legacy of Tommy Doherty? I just think that he made Manchester United a centre of entertainment, of vibrancy, recalled the Busby era. It brought back that Busby feeling, that swagger, which, when you look back, you know, on what's happened later, was very important and an important step in the rebuilding of Manchester United, the institution, as opposed to a football club.
I promised you last year we would bring the cup back, and we have brought the cup back to the finest supporters in the world.
This has been Barclay and Barton on Manchester United for another week. You can also download and subscribe to the podcast version of this very show by visiting lovesportradio.com. We'll be back next Saturday for episode 3, same time, 10 p.m. We'll see you then.
This is Love Sport.